This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 52 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And joining me today is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Hello, everybody.
And we have a familiar voice as our co-host today, and that is the Managing Editor of the Aviation Historian. Mick Oakey, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks very much for the invitation.
It's great to have you here. We're very sorry to have missed Gareth this evening. Gareth is a little under the weather. I think he has the virus that I am recovering from. So we wish him the very best and hope he gets better soon. But let's move on. Today's programme, we look at the news. We're going to talk to Mick about the Aviation Historian. Tim brings us an interview on the amazing Edgeley Optica, which he got to get to fly in. And we also hear from Sam Worthington Lease on the project to bring a Hawker Typhoon back to our skies. We've Get Involved and Promoting Aerospace. We've got another fully loaded show for you. So let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, and the first story we've got to look at is one that's certainly burning away in the UK, and that is, of course, the new consultation that the Civil Aviation Authority are bringing on air displays and low-flying permission charges. Tim, we've seen, obviously, the effects of the Shoreham, the very sad events at Shoreham last year already starting to take effect, but this is an added layer that's really causing some damage to the air displays this year. We've seen at least four air displays already go. Is this going to be the end of the British air show as we know it?
Well, let's hope not. I mean, I think there was always going to be, the CAA was going to kind of look at safety in the light of Shoreham, and I think that the things that they were talking about, obviously increased inspections and just sort of looking at things a bit more closely, supervision, checking things. That was all well and good, and they kind of announced this would be going forward, kind of new sort of stricter rules and supervision. But what's come out of kind of blue, and obviously this has to be paid for. But what has come out of the blue, I think, for the airshow community and for enthusiasts is the how steeply the charges have risen. So 100% sort of jump in charges, which for sort of smaller shows is sort of unsustainable. A lot of them say it's unsustainable. It's going to kind of close some of these smaller shows down. You're not really kind of making that much money out of it. Some of the smaller shows actually, kind of do a lot of donate some of their kind of profits to charity. There's been a online petition about it. I think it's over 10,000 signatures now to try and get the government to ask the CAA to reconsider charges. Actually, as we were recording, there is a a British Air Display Association meeting going on, where I'm sure that the CAA is having some sort of tough questions as to how does it justify this rise. And like you say, we've had four air shows now. We can't do it for 2016.
And Mick, one of the things that seems to be coming through from the industry is the effect on some of the historic aircraft, because they really exist in many instances simply to display, and it is the very, very small opportunity they have to create revenue to support them. And in almost all instances, they're charities in their own rights. What do you think this is going to have on the historical aircraft?
Yeah, I think particularly the aircraft, which really air shows are their only source of income, that is going to be a huge, huge problem. But there's a really interesting divergence going on here, because since the deregulation of pleasure flying in historic aircraft, suddenly anything with two seats and particularly Spitfires, that the business of pleasure flying is going through the roof. I was talking to one of my photographer friends, Richard Paver, who's famous particularly for aerial photography of Spitfires, and he's been doing quite a lot of work with some of the guys who are operating Spitfires on pleasure flights, and they're charging £2,500 a trip, doing 10 trips a day in the summer.
10 trips a day.
And you only have to do the math to realize how much money that's raking in. I mean, good on them. They're taking an opportunity and absolutely running with it. But of course, the other side of the coin with the air show proposals is that smaller single seat aircraft, where you haven't got the opportunity to take people pleasure flying and make a bit of extra revenue, it's getting ever more difficult for them to make ends meet.
There's also actually as well a kind of a knock-on effect, which if you think about it, where it might lead to, if you think about sort of the small areas, displays are, they're going to be charged extra for whatever item that turns up, but you think about something like the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. How many small air shows does it do? Kind of a flyby, a couple of Spitfires go past in the summer and just kind of waggle their wings and kind of a tiny little air shows. Once you start cutting down on those sort of shows all around the UK, then the rationale then for the Battle of Britain Memorial flight becomes more difficult to kind of justify as well, as to why do you have this flight if it's only going to be only going to be sort of seen at maybe Cosford or something.
It's a well promoted fact that air shows, certainly in the UK, are the second most popular outdoor interest item after,
that's right,
I think,
exactly,
football. 6 million people a year go to UK air shows. Now, of course, we're never going to get 6 million people to support the consultation and support the drive to make the CAA revisit some of this. But we certainly need to encourage more people to have a voice. And we've certainly all probably signed the documentation to get us up to the 10,000 mark. But, if we can get it higher to the 100,000 mark, we might get some serious interest and some serious focus back on this issue, because there's going to be a lot of disappointed people in the public who probably don't even know this is happening at the moment.
Widely publicised outside the aviation community.
Be interested to sort of see to know, possibly after this week, actually the further information from the sort of CAA's point of view as to argument that air show fees have been kind of held down for quite a while. We've been having it cheap, or what is the reason behind it, this jump in pricing?
Because the rationale
Maybe wait and just sort of see what the CAA has got to say for itself as well. But having said that, petition, write to your MP, and also the CAA, it's a consultation at the moment. So, the CAA form is there, it's online, go there. and you can sort of weigh in and sort of get involved directly, you know, and say exactly why you object.
Yeah, and we'll put links to that in the show notes as well. So if you haven't had the opportunity to have your say, we will give you the links to help you do that. Okay, let's move on to the next story, and sticking with displays but of a different type. At long last, it looks like we're going to get the F-35 to Europe, Tim, certainly to Farnborough, possibly to Riyadh as well. But also, interestingly, we saw an Italian F-35, an Italian-built F-35, make a transatlantic crossing this very last week. So it's all happening on the F-35 side.
Yeah, well, obviously, 2 years ago, the big news was the non-appearance of the F-35. You know, they had that engine fire. So the only F-35 you saw at kind of Farnborough at Riyadh was a plastic mock-up. Now they're talking about there's going to be five. So two from the Marines, two from the A-models from the USAF, and one RAF F-35B as well. Interestingly, and this is something you might have spotted if you're sort of like keen-eyed AV geek on Twitter, is that they are going to be doing a proper sort of roll demo and hovering. It sounds like hovering in front of the crowd, a la Harrier.
Wow.
So that's been practiced in the sim at the moment. The RAF pilot for that has been sort of practicing that. Now, whether it's going to be as low in as the Harrier does it in front of the crowd, or whether it's be able to do the usual bow that to the crowd that the Harrier did, I'm not entirely sure. But you know, we are promised a roll demo, so that'll be cool.
Yeah.
Important also that it's not going to be just Riyadh and Farnborough, but actually the international debut of the F-35 on air displays is actually going to be in the Netherlands. I think it's going to be at Leeuwarden beforehand. So,
wow. Okay. Good on the Dutch for getting that one. Gosh. Tim, just sticking with the British MOD, there was a story last week as well about them buying these high-flying solar planes. What was that all about?
That's now confirmed. We got briefed in it back in September before DSEI when someone let the cat out of the bag. And it was also mentioned in the SDSR, and that was sort of like, you know, we'll be next generation edge of space persistent, you know, platforms, which anyone had been following the story went, oh yeah, that's the Airbus, you know, Airbus Defence and Space Zephyr. It's being built in Farnborough. We're going to be taking two of them. And these things are solar-powered drones that can stay aloft for up to 3 months. And the Zephyr 8 can stay up to airborne for up to 3 months. So that is the plan.
Wow.
Zephyr holds the world record for endurance, you know, 2 weeks. 3 months, have two of them. They were talking about maybe having them work together. So, you know, kind of like a comms relay, all sorts of possibilities there. There's still trial. There's still sort of prototypes. There's still demonstrators. But it's kind of a pretty advanced and world beating kind of capability to have.
Yeah, very exciting. Very exciting. You mentioned Airbus there, Tim. Airbus have been in the news an awful lot over the last few weeks, as has their competitors Boeing. But Airbus managed to steal the march on Boeing for the orders in Iran, and they managed to get the first order, 118 Airbuses, 45 A320s, 45 A330s, 16 A350s, and 12 A380s. Now, that was followed very, very quickly by ATR managing to convince Iran Air to buy 20 ATR turboprops as well. ATR 72s, I think they were. Good news for the Europeans, but is there any reason why the Americans were so slow to get in there and get these orders?
I think they've got more political concerns and kind of exploiting, you know, well, you know, do business there. They've got to be a little bit more careful, a little bit more sensitive due to kind of concerns in Washington about you know, kind of Iran suddenly being the you know, then everybody's new best friend. You know, if you look at what's been happening recently, you know, the Iran went and captured some U.S. sailors. That didn't go down particularly well. So, they've got to be a bit more careful. But having said that, there are reasons. I mean, if Iran sort of stays on the straight and narrow, as it were, and they're so behind in their civil aviation that there's going to be enough work to go around for everybody. So that, they want.
Yeah, I mean that's a massive order, though, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, and more importantly for Airbus, 12 A380 orders.
12 A380s. Now, there's some people sort of say, well, do they actually need 12 A380s? From nothing. But they're aiming high, and what they're trying to aim to do is to try and to be the, they see themselves, now they're in from the cold as being, possibly able to rival. Dubai, Abu Dhabi, as a, sort of have that as a sort of a new Middle Eastern stroke Gulf aviation hub.
Yeah.
They're on the route to Asia Pacific, and also unlike the UEA, where it's all sort of transfer traffic and it's people coming there. Iran has got a youngish, educated populace, middle class, growing middle class, desperate to travel. There's a substantial domestic market. You look at that and you think, maybe they have got a plan. There's some sort of smart technicians there who've been keeping, aviation technicians there who've been keeping F-14s and F-4s flying for, donkey's years.
Absolutely. And, there's 747s still flying there. The 100s. I think there's some SPs still flying there, isn't there?
Got to be a little bit careful of getting overexcited about it. I mean, it's a potential big market, and people are going, well, sales, this is an untapped market. But Iran, it's still seen as a sort of a regional threat in some quarters, and it could also go rapidly sort of south. They're basically still on probation, so it's a good deal for Airbus. We'll have to sort of wait and see whether these aircraft get delivered, in time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sticking with Airbus, we saw the A320neo, the first delivery of that aircraft made in the last month. We also saw the first flight of the Boeing 737 MAX as well. So great news for both the big manufacturers on that front. But again, Airbus have stole the march by getting the first new generation aircraft out. Not to Qatar, who were the original launch customers, though.
That's right. I mean, they that was swapped. The first aircraft went to Lufthansa instead. A bit of a low key event on the 20th of January. The first we knew about it was when kind of press release pinged in and said we've handed it over. About sort of three people in the plus the photographer in a hangar in Hamburg. Three CEOs. So completely change from many of the usual sort of handovers or first deliveries, what have you. Lufthansa put this straight into service. I think it was just about sort of five six days later. Put this straight into service. Kind of a shame, really, because they didn't even kind of put any sort of like special graphics on it or anything like that to say it was a neo. You had to kind of look at, obviously the bigger engines are a giveaway. So hopefully they are going to do something. A little bird tells me that there might be some sort of celebrations in the not too near future. Actually, of they're going to mark it properly.
Okay. And Mick, just to come to you from a historical angle, I'm starting to see Airbus aircraft now being seen as historic aircraft, like the A300, the original Airbus. People talking about it from a historical perspective. It's bizarre to me because I suppose I've lived through it all. But what's the view of Airbus and maybe some of its older models?
Well, I think we all know we're getting old when aeroplanes that we think are modern kind of start appearing in museums and stuff. Airbuses aren't quite at that stage
Mick.
Yet. But I think... in a way, because Airbus has got such a strong brand and such a strong continuity of style through all of its models since the start. You know, you can kind of look at an Airbus and recognize it as an Airbus. It's not like Boeing aircraft, which, you know, started off in 1915 as fabric-covered biplanes and things like this. Airbus has got a strong identity that's carried all the way through, and it is difficult to imagine the sheer length of time that they've been in service, because an old Airbus, yeah, okay, it does look different from a new one, but not that different.
No, I know. There's lots of comments on social media about that at the moment, and whether they're all looking much of a likeness. But we better not enter that fray now. Let's move on and come to space then. Tim, we've not talked since Tim Peake launched and has, of course, undertaken that historic spacewalk. He's doing a fantastic job on the outreach side, certainly to schools and to youngsters in this part of the world. He's becoming a real hero, isn't he?
Definitely. I mean, you know, the Aries stuff, we knew a packed and busy schedule, but boy, is it sort of, you know, that's a really good sort of outreach, you know, teaching school kids, you know, taking the sort of, you know, school class from lessons from space. Yeah. How cool is that? They're doing kids programming. People are kind of playing along with his space rocks stuff, sharing his pictures. You know, he's got some great pictures of sort of, like, you know, lightning and going off, time-lapse pictures. Really, really good stuff. You know, there's even stuff where he kind of hung up the, I think it was the Stoke City banner, and 2 days later they beat Man U, which I don't know if that's connected, but maybe it is. Who knows?
Yeah. And I mean, amongst all of this, he did, of course, carry out that historic spacewalk. And certainly, I know for a small country like ours, that was quite a monumental step for us, a very historic step. He was very cool, wasn't he? He did a very good job.
Know, it was great to see two Tims out of the you know, two Tims in space, yep, at once. And you know, there's been a lot of you know, there was some discussion going on about on social media about was he really the first Brit in space? Considering we'd had sort of you know, sort of Piers Sellers and other British-born astronauts, and you know. You know, is it sort of jingoistic or nationalistic to kind of get excited about, because he'd got a Union, yeah, flag on his arm, you know, but I think, you know, it is significant, because this is the first, you know, sort of government sponsored sort of spacewalk. You know, it is the UK fully behind human spaceflight for once, whereas you know, Helen Sharman, she went there. It was an agreement with you know, the post Gorbachev, really. You know, I think it was the Russian government that paid it. Yeah. Basically paid for her.
Since Tim launched to the space station, we've seen the UK government come out and the UK Space Agency come out in support of further ongoing international efforts to explore space, and certainly support behind new robotic missions to the moon and Mars as well. So he's done a great job to accelerate that agenda. And I know this government, whatever we think of it politically, is doing a lot to support the aerospace industry. So so well done to them. I just want to wrap up the final news story. Mick, I want to come to you. RAF, the RAF Museum and RAF Hendon, we were there all 4 or 6 weeks ago with a special episode. Fantastic place. I still can't believe it's free to get in there, but there's some big changes coming.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you covered a fair bit of the ground about those changes when you did your broadcast over Christmas. But increasingly and more frequently, they're announcing the new phases of this £4.5 million facelift that they're giving the whole Hendon site. So they're going to be re-landscaping part of the site. They're going to grass over the car park in an attempt to make the way you come into the museum look a bit more like the Hendon Aerodrome as it was in Claude Graham White's day before World War One, and also make parts of the site look more like RAF Hendon, like a functioning Royal Air Force station. And at the same time, there's going to be massive changes in the Battle of Britain Hall, not before time, some people would argue. They're changing the milestones of Flight Hall, I think, to be a more sort of science and technology-led exhibit, more to in support of the kind of STEM education, science, technology, engineering, maths education side of things. And I think, okay, the World War One exhibition is going to stay pretty much the same, but that's a fantastic exhibition and has stepped the whole museum up in terms of the quality of its exhibits. And with a slightly historical perspective, I'm looking at all these new developments that they're planning to put in place. And I'm thinking back to, do you remember the Battle of Britain Beacon project, which they launched, or they officially announced it in 2010? And it was going to be this kind of cooling tower-shaped thing in front of the museum where they were going to suspend Spitfires and Hurricanes. I was always a bit suspicious of that idea, and I didn't think it was a great one. In the end, I think it was a mixture of funding and planning issues which scuppered that. But I really feel like the new development is a much better idea.
Well, we look forward to that. And again, well done to the museum for moving things forward on that front. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We've still got a look at the aviation historian to come. We've got a great interview that Tim had on a talk about his flight in the Edgeley Optica. We've got the Hawker Typhoon restoration, a new X10 Top 10 to come, and lots more. So after this break, we'll come back to talk to Mick.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Okay, Mick, the aviation historian. Lots of listeners will have heard your voice talking about it on our advertorials. But tell us a little bit about the magazine, because it isn't a magazine, really, is it? It's a bit different. What makes it so different?
Well, we say it's not a magazine, it's a journal. So it's a quarterly, and it's halfway between a magazine and a book. It's perfect bound, so it's got a square spine like a paperback book, and it's compact format, so it's not your standard A4 magazine. It's very similar in format to National Geographic, which everybody's quite familiar with. So a lovely thick wodge of information. It's about the size of an Osprey book, if you're familiar with Osprey books. And the whole point of it is to be a counterpart and a complement to the mainstream monthlies like Aeroplane and Flypast. Aeroplane is where I cut my teeth and ended up working for 29 years, 12 of years as editor, and I don't know where all that time went. Had a wonderful time, but when Aeroplane was sold in 2010 to new owners, I took the opportunity to retire, and then I kind of couldn't keep away. So we launched the Aviation Historian in 2012 to be something that looked different, felt different, the nearest equivalent to the Aviation Historian that people might remember is Air Enthusiast Quarterly. They're not the same. Aviation Historian is very much its own publication. But in terms of in-depth material about historical subjects, that's about the nearest equivalent.
Yeah, I'm by no means an expert on aviation history, but I think certainly from the seven or eight issues that I've got and have read through, You've got a very unique style. The features you do are very, very different. You have managed to find stories that are absolutely beyond me in terms of I wouldn't have even thought about them. But just looking at the current the current issue, which is 14, and by the way, they do look very good on the bookshelf. I must say, for all our aviation book fans, there's some fantastic content. And the one thing that I love about it is I'm learning so much about the history of aviation, and it's not just the post-war developments or Spitfire. There's some really good pre-war stuff. There's some very good early flight content. And you manage to get stories from all over the world. I think in this edition, there's you're in the Middle East and in Lebanon. And there's some fantastic photography from back in the 50s of aviation in Lebanon. How do you find these stories? Where are you getting them from?
Well, we're fantastically lucky that when we were on aeroplane, when I say we, me and my former deputy editor, Nick Stroud, who is now the editor of The Aviation Historian. I'm the managing editor, for which read interfering old git. And when we were on aeroplane, we have this huge network of authors and contributors worldwide. And when we started TAH, we brought a lot of those people with us. When we first launched the journal, Nick and I were so worried about, who are we going to get to write for us and how on earth are we going to get enough material? But we contacted all our old chums, our old contributors, and everybody without exception said, yeah, we'll write for you. And so yeah. We have a constant deluge of stuff coming in to the extent it surprises us. And it's like Christmas every day, really.
It really is. Well, Mick, let's have a look at issue 14. It's only been out for, I think, a couple of weeks.
Yeah, maybe it was published on January the 15th.
I think of all your publication, I'm not just saying this because you're on the show, but this is probably the best. I mean, the diversity of content in here is amazing. There were four that I picked out that I wanted to ask you about. The first one was the story on Vickers. And again, I learned so much. The V-1000, I never knew there was a civilian variant of the Valiant.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of those stories, like a lot of our stories, where a lot of enthusiasts are vaguely aware they're vaguely aware of the story, but they have no idea of the detail. And it comes as something of a revelation when they realise, like with everybody knows the Vickers VC-10, which came later and was largely a great success. But they don't know about the V-1000 and the civil version of the V-1000, which was going to be the VC-7 airliner.
It's quite an attractive. You've managed to recreate some of the graphics as well of what the aircraft might have looked like. And it's not fancy CGI we're talking about. We're talking about some really good, strong silhouette graphics here. And it's really interesting. And I suppose what took me from that was it looks really modern, actually, and this was an aircraft designed in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, it's clean. I mean, it had engines embedded in the wings, so it looked a bit like a de Havilland Comet, but a considerably more futuristic and streamlined, and all the flying surfaces swept back. So it did look a lot more futuristic than a Comet, but it was almost like, almost from the start, everybody but Vickers, so when I say everybody, I mean the Air Ministry, the airlines, the RAF, they were all kind of tiptoeing around it. Nobody seemed to be quite prepared to say, we're going to go for that. And it was like everybody was worried that they didn't want to be left with the blame if it all went horribly wrong. Typical aviation story, you might say.
Well, certainly from our British post-war heritage, it sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, and some people say, that was a turning point in British civil transport aviation design from which the country never recovered, really.
Yeah, I was just going to talking about sort of the talk about the graphics and the illustrations in there, Mick. obviously really sort of like varied and great sort of variety of in-depth and unusual articles to get your teeth in. But I really have to say there's some excellent sort of illustrations as well there, Ian Bott and others there that kind of really kind of add to the features as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very lucky to have Ian. Obviously, we worked with him for many, many years on Aeroplane. And when we started TAH, we asked Ian to join us and become a member of our editorial board, partly to sort of steer the graphics in the magazine, in the journal, and to some extent break new ground. Some of the graphics he's doing for us, they're way ahead of things that you see anywhere else. And that's because his day job, he does infographics for the Financial Times, and he works for the Aviation Historian and Aeroplane and other magazines in his spare time because he happens to be an aviation nut.
But it's not just about British aviation, is it? The great thing about the features you do is that it's truly international, and we do have a very, very strong following from the US, yeah, and from the Americas, and you've got a great item in there about VX4 as well, and of course the Tomcat, the black Tomcat, is in there. Some fantastic and what looks like pretty original photography in there of that, and the F4 as well.
Yeah, for people who don't know the story, VX4 was a US Navy aircraft evaluation unit, and one of their COs one day got chatting to Hugh Hefner, who presumably over a drink or several, gave permission for the unit to paint the Playboy bunny on the fins of its aeroplanes. And this went on for years. So you had fantastic things like black phantoms with a white Playboy bunny on the tail. They looked absolutely amazing. It was painted up as a one-off, and everybody thought it looked so amazing that from then on they kept the sort of flagship of VX4 would always be an all-black aircraft with a white bunny on the tail.
Can't really sort of see that happening now, can you?
Not really.
No.
it's not very politically correct, is it?
We've just designated the 43 sort of squadron TSES as the FHM squadron.
Yes,
that's right. That's right.
There is a story that the bunny on the tail came to an end because the unit got a new CO, and the CO's wife violently objected to this terribly politically incorrect symbol. So it all sort of faded away. As time goes on, a lot of people come along to try and suck the fun out of things. Such a shame.
Well, talking about fun, I'm not quite sure if it's fun or not, but let's wrap up with the final article in the latest issue, and that is, of course, the AirCab project. And I got to say, Mick, I never knew a single thing. I didn't even think that this could have existed. How did this go unnoticed by almost everybody in the aviation world?
Isn't it incredible? We just don't know. I mean, I was only faintly, dimly aware myself of this story. For people who don't know it, AirCab is a sort of funny acronym that stands for Aircrew Escape Rescue Capability. And it was a Vietnam-era project. The basic idea was, if you were in a combat aircraft over Vietnam, an American combat aircraft, and you got shot at and your aircraft was disabled, you would then eject. But the big difference was that your ejection seat would then somehow sprout wings and a rotor or a jet engine and could then fly you to safety. And they actually seriously did this. Only in America did they consider such a project. It's bonkers. The article covers three different versions of AirCab, which were done by different manufacturers. So the main version of AirCab that we cover in the article is the one that was produced by Command, the helicopter people. And if you can imagine an ejection seat where you eject from your aircraft and then your seat, A, sprouts fins, B, a little turbofan engine kicks into action behind the small of your back. And C, above your head, a rotor unfolds. So you've basically got a jet-powered autogyro, which can then fly you from where you've been shot down to a safe landing ground or ideally over friendly lines. A completely bonkers idea. But that wasn't the most bonkers, because the other two that we cover in the article, one was produced by Bell, that was called the Bell Parawing. Now, with that one, you ejected from the aeroplane, your seat effectively tipped forward, so you were facing the ground, and behind you, a regalo wing, like the old-style hang gliders, would unfold behind you, and you'd hopefully have a little turbojet engine behind you, and so you would be flying face down under this regalo wing. It's completely barking mad, but they seriously considered it.
Well, there's plenty more stories like that in the Aviation Historian. Issue 14 is just out. Mick, how can we get hold of it? What does it cost, and how does that all work?
Right. Well, we sell virtually all our issues via our website, which is theaviationhistorian.com. You can buy individual issues in the UK for £12.50, in Europe for £15, rest of the world for £17. Might sound a bit expensive, but it's about the same price as an Osprey book. Those prices include postage. And you can also subscribe. So a subscription in the UK costs £44, including postage. That's 4 issues a year, and considerably more for overseas. But we also have a digital edition for anybody who prefers to read on a iPad or something like that. We like to say by design, but it's really by pure fluke that the format of the Aviation Historian is about the same as a standard iPad screen. So it works brilliantly well on an iPad.
Yeah, it does. And just to put it into context, we're talking about 130 pages for each issue as well. So it is more like a book than a magazine.
It's the amount of stuff you get in a book, but it's like a magazine format because you're covering maybe 15, 16 or more different subjects between one set of covers.
And as we said, certainly the graphics, but also the photography is almost unique as well. You will not get to see some of these photographs anywhere else than in this magazine. So, Mick, thanks very much for that. Thanks for joining us. We've got plenty more to come. After the break, we're going to hear Tim's interview and feedback from his flight on the Edgeley Optica.
Hi, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's own aviation podcast. I like to listen to Extended.
Here we are, an Aviation Extended podcast, and I'm here with John Edgeley, designer of the iconic Optica aircraft, one of the most unusual aircraft ever built in the UK. First flown in the 1979, this ducted van surveillance aircraft is unlike anything else in the sky. It's perhaps one of the few fixed-wing aircraft with the outstanding visibility of a helicopter. John, welcome to the Extended. Tell me, how did the Optica come about? Where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea came because I decided there was a need for air-to-ground observation, and so I set about designing an aircraft that will fulfil that need. I think the idea of it being a commercial type aircraft for commercial spotting was really quite an early idea. So I went very much from a specification, as I believe one should with an aeroplane. You go from a specification to a design that meets that specification. I didn't suddenly think up the shape of the Optica in a flash.
And what are the advantages then compared to a helicopter or traditional fixed-wing aircraft?
Well, the advantage to traditional fixed-wing aircraft is, of course, the visibility. I mean, you just had a flight, Tim, and you know that the visibility is really quite outstanding, and you just don't get that sort of visibility in a conventional fixed-wing aircraft. Compared to a helicopter, the advantages, one, would be cost, that it's well recognised that a fixed-wing aircraft is a third or less of the price of a helicopter to operate commercially. And the other one is range and endurance, which the Optica would be much better on than a helicopter.
Because and smoothness.
Well, and I should have said, and smoothness. I mean, when you photograph from the aircraft, as you saw, you took photographs yourself. You don't need complicated gimbal-mounted cameras and so on. And in fact, in the early days of the optical flying, Movitone News did a lot of video. Well, it wouldn't have been video; it would have been 16mm film from the. And they never used any stabilizing whatever.
It is incredibly. I mean, the view from there, it's like sort of flying in a magic carpet. You know, being there, sort of perch on there, the all-round view is amazing.
And very smooth. And, of course, the smoothness is an advantage from the point of view of any photography or recording that you do, and also from the point of view of the fatigue, the observer and pilot fatigue. It's important.
It's also very quiet as well, isn't it? And I suppose that's good for kind of keeping tabs on people on who don't want to be kept tabs on.
It is. It's quiet both from inside the cockpit. I don't know if you tried taking the headphones off.
I did. Yep.
But you need the headphones to listen to the tower. But actually, you can converse in the aircraft quite easily without. And also outside the aircraft. It is very quiet. It's a completely different tone. If an optica flies overhead, you know it's an optica. You don't need to actually look up to see that it is.
Mm. Okay. In the past, I mean, the program, it had some setbacks in the past. It had there was a tragic crash and a fire destroying the production aircraft. So how did that affect plans?
There was the unfortunate crash of an early... and of course, the problem is that it took some time for the accident report. Accident reports typically take a year to come out, and meanwhile, a company has got to keep going during that year, and that is, of course, very difficult. And that was really why that was a big hiccup early on. Yes, and it was a great shame.
And how many opticas were built? Where are they flying now?
Well, this morning you flew in number 21. There were actually 22 of them completed. Number 22 is in Australia, and as far as I know, is still operational out there, together with the second one flying in Australia.
And they were doing, was it sightseeing type?
As far as I know, the ones in Australia, yes, sightseeing. Yeah, and there are two in the United States as well currently. As far as I know, both currently flying.
Okay. And the obviously, last year, the Force Awakens came out, Star Wars, but the Optica's got a Star Wars connection, hasn't it, with Mark Hamill flying it in a 1989 film, Slipstream.
There was a film, Slipstream,
yes. Yeah, how did that come about?
I've no idea. I wasn't involved in organising that or in the project at that stage. I think that was in the mid-80s, wasn't
it?
Yes. Yes, I did see the film. Thought the flying was brilliant.
So you're here now with it. It's kind of... back. You flew to Paris last year. What's the current situation of the Optica program, and what are you hoping to kind of achieve with it?
Well, I after the mid 80s, I then ceased to have an involvement, and in fact went on to other projects, and I've done a glider project that was really proven quite successful. And various other projects I went into. But then about 7 years ago, I was approached, would I like to get involved in the Optica again? And I thought that seemed to be a good idea to do that, because I've always felt my involvement was a plus for the project. Yeah. And I felt I could perhaps do a little bit better with it than some other people had done. And so that's why I got involved. And when I did, I took on two opticas, one of which you flew today, that were currently at that stage 7 years ago not flying. They'd both been on contract to the Spanish government, very successfully for forest fire surveillance work. And I decided the main thing was to get an optica flying in the UK first, which I did. And then to see if we can get back into production in some form or another.
Okay. And you took the aircraft to Le Bourget last year. What was the kind of interest there?
There was a great deal. They loved to see the aircraft back, and there were those that remembered us when we were there previously, and it was quite some time since we'd been there. As Flight International reported in the show daily, we were the only UK-built aircraft that was in the show.
True. That's right.
I'm not sure that actually is completely true, because they're probably helicopters. Yeah. I think we've got to say a UK fixed-wing aircraft in the show, yes.
So
there was a great deal of interest, and it was a pretty busy 4 days, because I was there with it. Mm.
So you're now trying to attract a buyer for the project. So what exactly are you kind of offering then? It's a production certificate or a design authority, or
we hold the everything that's needed to get the Optica back into production. In other words, we've got a full set of jigs and tools in store. We've got the demonstrator that you flew in today. We've got another aircraft that could become a demonstrator, could be refurbished, another one of the Spanish ones. We've got a part-built aircraft. We've got components for a further 5 aircraft. We've got all the manufacturing records, and we've got the manufacturing and inspection records. We've got all the technical data that led to the certification, so that if one wanted to make any modifications or modernization in any way to the aircraft, you've got a strong base for doing all that work. The aircraft, originally certificated by the CA, now has a full EASA C of A and a FAA certification and Australian certification. So we're basically offering the complete package for going back into production with it. And I feel, and I'm not the only one that feels this, that there's still as much of a need for the aircraft today as there was when I originally designed it.
Would the Optica need to be updated in any way for today's market? I'm thinking, would you have avionics, glass cockpit, or some kind of sensor boil on there for kind of, EO or sensor boil?
Well, I mean, you really said it in terms of the instrumentation. Instrumentation and avionics has changed a lot in 30 years, but it is relatively easy to retrofit a GA aircraft, and we've looked into that. It's not the companies that provide packages, and it would not be difficult.
And if you were to play devil's advocate, and say, right, okay, surveillance platforms. So, what would you say to people who said that the Optica has now been superseded by UAVs, unmanned systems? That
I would say that UAV shows that there's a need for air-to-ground observation. and there's a big need for air-to-ground observation. And I think that there are cases where it's better to have a person up there than simply a camera. And there are also, I think, situations in which it's cheaper to fly an aircraft. After all, if you fly an aircraft, you've got a pilot and an observer in it. You've got two people involved. Some of these UAV programs, if they're out of line of sight, they need enormous teams. I wouldn't like to say how many, but you probably know the sort of size of team you need to fly a UAV. That must surely cost more money than flying an Optica. Yeah.
And also, you've got the drinking straw problem with the, if you're in the UAV, you've got the sensor ball. You only look where the sensor ball is, and you can miss something that's...
Indeed, yes.
I think there are some roles where you need to do interpretive analysis as well. UAV will say, what's there? If you've got a pilot looking down, you'll say, that's what's there. Oh, but look at that over there. And this could change the situation.
Yeah.
So particularly in a moving or developing situation, you're tracking game, for example, or looking for police work or something like that, or border control, this could be important to have a man in what I call active observation.
Yeah. What sort of interest from you mentioned sort of firefighting, Spanish firefighting, but what sort of other missions or roles have been suggested? I believe the Australian one was used for sightseeing.
The Australian one was sightseeing, yes. Yeah. Fire surveillance does seem to be quite a popular one as far as we can make out, and indeed it is what it was used for with the Spanish government, and they're not wanting to fly helicopters in that situation continuously because of the cost of it.
Yeah.
Because of the cost. But then there are other things like the obvious ones like border patrol. There's power and pipeline patrol, which can they can possibly be done more as easily with UAVs, in fact, because it's always flying the same course and you're only looking at one specific thing. But certainly the fire one and border patrol.
Wild game.
And also Mike's mentioned wild game, yes. Mm.
And also there's another role as well, Tim, I think. SAR used helicopters traditionally. But there's a lot of SAR gets into action after the event has got critical. Yeah. Somebody says, oh my God, there's somebody in trouble in the boat out there. But if you have a routine patrol, you anticipate the problem. You can't afford to do that with a helicopter because it's so expensive to run. You could actually use this complementary to the helicopter force, as I see it, as a routine patrol.
Border patrol does seem to be becoming more and more important with all the difficulties that we've had and countries having to look out for their own borders.
Yeah. Mm. So my next question would be, UAVs is one aspect, but given the explosion in surveillance platforms over the past decade and a half, you know, everything from Setters to DA-42 to King Airs, I mean, turned into low-cost surveillance platforms. Do you think perhaps the Optica was an idea ahead of its time?
Well, it's certainly been said to me, and I would like to think so, yes. Yes, it's been said to me by several people ahead of its time, and maybe its time has arrived now. That's our that's what we certainly hope. Yeah, and there's certainly people that will look at the Optica now and look at a conventional aircraft beside it and say, oh, we like the look of the new aircraft. But actually, of course, the Optica's older in many cases.
Really?
But it still looks like the latest. It still looks like the latest thing.
And finally, final question. You're obviously a member of chairman of the RAS General Aviation Group, which has helped introduce new rules for experimental aircraft in the UK. That was a big milestone last year. Would that have helped you in the past in developing the Optica? And do you think that we're now set for a renaissance in UK light aircraft design with designers, you know, today's young designers perhaps inspired by the Optica, as to kind of go and think out of the box a little bit more?
I think that once it really gets going and people really realise what e-conditions are, I think it's going to help enormously, yes, and I think we're going to get a big take-up of it. It certainly would have helped me originally when I built the original prototype, and it could even help us now, actually, because if we want to do experimental work on the... I mean, this isn't why I did the experimental conditions. I mean, it was an entirely separate issue. But I have realised, since it's been through, that we could actually be making use of it for doing investigatory work on the Optica as well, for making improvements and so on. Because one of the things about e-conditions, it's not only for new build, which was actually my motive of doing it, was to encourage new build of aircraft... But there is also that possibility of using it for making improvements to existing aircraft.
Would it be just avionics you'd be looking at, or would there be any sort of performance updates or any engine you might kind of...
The Optica's never really had any serious work on it to increase performance. Therefore, there is bound to be scope for improving performance. Mm. And it really is good, the encouragement the Royal Aeronautical Society have given for the e-conditions too. It's been really an essential feature of it.
Fantastic. Excellent. Well, I think that's...
It's taken 10 years to get that through, so I don't give up.
Brilliant. Right, well, John Edgley, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure, Tim.
Tim, really lucky to have gone up in an Edgley Optica. As we mentioned earlier, it's one of those aircraft that certainly I've seen through my aviation interest evolve. I was surprised to see they were still flying, but I think the thing that really stood out for me from your chat after the flight was the belief that there's still a lot of potential for this aircraft to be further developed.
Yeah, I mean, it's you think of the explosion, the growth in ISR and light surveillance stuff over the past sort of 10 years. You know, everyone's sticking, you have to go to kind of Farnborough or Riyadh or Farnborough Paris or any sort of trade show anyway, and people would be sticking sort of sensor balls on marker lights, Cessnas, King Airs, you name it, it'll have a sensor ball and be marketed as an ISR platform. Obviously, you've got UAVs now, which have kind of come in and sort of dominated yeah. the market space. But having said that, there has been in at least maybe past couple of years, maybe past three years, a realization that UAVs do have limitations, and that there are roles where you say, well, you know, maybe it's a bit better to have a manned aircraft there who have a wide field of view. Because obviously the thing with UAVs is you've got the drinking straw, you've got the sensor ball, the sensor operator's looking at it, and you've got that tiny, tiny, narrow field of view that you've got to be right exactly on the right, looking at the right place. And if something is, a few metres off to the right and you're, a few metres off to the left, you're not going to see it. Whereas if you've got something like a surveillance, sort of asset like the Optica, you've got this great all-round view to spot stuff going on. I think they will need to be updated. I think they're going to have a think about what can we do. You know, glass cockpit is one obvious suggestion. Maybe there's sort of a diesel power plant. Maybe some kind of sensor ball, maybe. But yeah, it's good to have good prospects.
And what was the visibility like? It's sort of slightly surreal, that aircraft, isn't it? It's just bizarre.
It's really low down. First off, you're kind of low down to the ground, so you're kind of trundling along on the runway like a go kart, and then you kind of leap up into the air brisk takeoff, short takeoff. It's not a stall aircraft, but it gets in the air quite quickly. And then you've got this, great view all around. But, one thing I would say, it's probably not recommended for anyone with vertigo. You've got the bubble canopy, and this is a sort of a serious point in that the aircraft that tragically crashed with the police, the Hampshire police in the 80s, one of the things that they believe happened was that he was the observer. There was an observer and a pilot in there, and that they believe that the observer, nothing wrong with, technically wrong with the aircraft, no faults found in that. But what they think happened was because you get such a view, and because you've got such a nice sort of helicopter type view, it was banking, and the observer reached for a handhold or something to hang on to, thought he was falling out, had the sensation of falling out, and what's in the middle of the aircraft, about sort of hand height, a control stick.
So, I remember the report on that. It's going back a long time, but
it does seem to have been around forever, doesn't it? And I see it at the Odd Air Show as well.
Paris, and what was amusing in Paris was obviously, people going up sort of saying, gosh, is this a new time? And they were saying, no, it flew in 1979, which is quite amusing. And the other thing was, there was no hawk there at Paris last year, I believe. So it was the only British built, designed, British designed and built air, fixed wing aircraft at the air show.
At the whole of the Paris air show.
Yeah, wow. The whole of the Paris air show. Even though, you know, we do the wings for Airbus, and there's Rolls Royce engines here, there, and everywhere. And you know, you've got all these current. That was the only fixed wing British aircraft at an international air show. You know, amazing.
I often think that the Optica. It's got parallels with David Lockspire's LDA, the Land Development Aircraft, or Boxer. It's one of those fantastically unorthodox types. It's a good aeroplane, but for one reason or another, it's never quite had its moment in the sun.
True. I mean, was it the aircraft that was that went up in the same fire? Did that not a prototype of that land?
That's a good point. I can't remember if it was the same, but it was destroyed, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's a good nearest equivalent now to the Optogram is an aircraft called the Seeker. I think at one point it was going to be produced in Jordan, but I think it's now in the US or Australia, and that's you know, slow flying, got a great view, used for kind of border patrol, anti-poaching patrol, stuff like that, and that seems to be doing okay. So, you know, you want something like that, you know, maybe that's the clue, you know, if there's a market or not.
Yeah, that's right. And as John Edgley said, the operating costs are massively lower than that of a helicopter.
Definitely, yeah.
It certainly must be. Well, good luck to them. Let's hope to see it for another 30 or 40 years in the skies. Okay, after the break then, I get the chance to speak to Sam Worthington-Lee. So I pop down to Goodwood, that's your part of the world, Mick, to see about a new project to restore a Hawker Typhoon.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
My name is Sam Worthington-Lease. I'm from the Hawker Typhoon Restoration Project. We're restoring Hawker Typhoon RB396.
Sam, how did you come across restoring a typhoon?
Good question. It's not something everyone decides to do every day. Dave Robinson, the project lead, has been researching the typhoon since 1999, when he found out that his house, his previous house, was built on the old maintenance unit. So he did a little bit of digging, and he was really interested in the typhoon story and found that it was completely underrepresented. So he decided to try and build a collection of parts just for his own personal interest. And in 2012, that changed into more of a project when he got the opportunity to buy the rear fuselage section,
right? Okay.
Of RB396.
Well, we'll come back to the airframe. Let's talk a little bit about the aircraft first. What made the Typhoon different? What was its service? I remember making the Airfix model when I was little. That's as much as I know about it.
Yeah, likewise, as did I. It was originally designed as the follow-on to the Hawker Hurricane. And they first flew very early in the 1940s, actually. They were around at the time of the Battle of Britain, played with design problems.
Yeah.
Didn't really get going until 1942. And they were only saved, really, because they were the only fighter at the time fast enough to catch the Fokker Wolf 190 on their sort of tip and run raids.
Yeah.
So the Typhoon was kept. And it then really developed a niche in the ground attack role, close air support ground attack role.
So was it designed more as a fighter and then transited to ground
attack? Absolutely. It was designed as an intercept fighter.
Right.
It had a very thick wing, very thick cord. So it didn't perform particularly well at high altitude,
right,
which then led to the Tempest with a redesigned wing. And the Typhoon really found its niche, really below 10,000 feet, close air support, because it carried a huge punch and it withstood a lot of punishment.
And she looks like she's got a lot of power and a bit of grunt in the front of her with the big engine intake.
Yeah, the Napier Sabre 2,200 horsepower as standard. Some later ones were up to 3,500. The big radiator scoop underneath the spinner just gives it a mean look.
Unique sound.
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, one hasn't run since the 1950s.
Yeah.
So there's no really good sound recordings, but old videos that you can see on YouTube, they're a bit different to the Merlin.
Yeah.
You can tell it's packing a bit more.
Yeah. Now, you've got a link to the Typhoon other than just pure interest, haven't you?
Absolutely. My grandfather, pilot officer, when he got shot down, pilot officer Roy Worthington, he flew the Typhoon. Before that, he flew the Hurricane. He flew the Typhoon in the war. He got shot down in May 1944 by flak, we believe.
In a Typhoon.
In a Typhoon.
Yeah.
And force landed in Holland.
Right.
That Typhoon, on that day, he took off from RAF West Hampnett, which is now Goodwood Aerodrome, and that is where I'm a flying instructor.
So tell me a little bit about your flying career then, because you're a pilot at the moment, aren't you? Tell us how you came to sit behind a stick.
I, ever since I can remember, I've always wanted to be a Spitfire pilot, basically.
Right.
And that led me to air shows and getting involved in gliding in around about 2006. In 2009, I joined the Air Force, following in my grandfather's footsteps.
Did your father do anything
funnily
in
enough,
aviation?
Father and mother have not really got
skipped
an interest
generation.
In it yet. My dad's a merchant navyman,
right?
But
okay.
Grandfather was Air Force. Nan was Air Force. They met in the Air Force during the war. And mum, no, she's not got an interest.
Right.
But I joined the Air Force in 2009, started flying training, and was made redundant in 2011 as
right.
a result of the government's defence review 2010.
Yeah.
Came out, got a commercial licence, and then came into instructing as I finished that commercial licence. So early part of 2013, flew the Tiger Moth, which my granddad would have learnt to fly on, and I now fly a Harvard, which was the advanced trainer, which again he would have transitioned on to before going on to his first fighter, which was the Hurricane.
So you're a flight instructor, are you now?
That's right.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Right.
So you instruct at Goodwood.
Yeah.
And what do you instruct on?
So we've got a Harvard.
Yeah.
A 1943 Harvard 2B.
Wow.
A Piper Cub, which is a small tailwheel trainer, and a fleet of Cessna 172s, which are arguably the most popular training aircraft in the world. Certainly the most common.
You've just had some further requalification as well, haven't you?
Yes. As part of the ATPL, I have an instrument rating. So you've got a commercial license and an instrument rating. And the instrument rating, if you don't use it commercially, you can renew every year to keep it current. And I just did that at the start of, the end of January,
right,
down in Exeter.
Right, okay. So let's come back to the airframe. Tell me a little bit about where Dave found this airframe and what you've actually got here.
Sure. So the part of the airframe that gives RB396 its identity is this rear fuselage. So if you look at the Typhoon from the side, imagine from the rear of the canopy to the front of the tail, we've got that section of fuselage,
right? Okay.
Which is from RB396 174 squadron. It wore the letters XPW, and that was shot down in early 1945.
Whereabouts?
In Holland. Sam?
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So a lot of Holland
there's a
going
lot of
on. Yeah.
Connections here.
A lot of connections in Holland. And for that reason, they're keen for us to go over when it's finished. But yes, this section of the fuselage, I think, was bought after the war by a chemical company.
Yeah.
And they were, I believe, going to use it as a wash, you know, block off the ends and have it sort of rotating with what they do with chemicals. Luckily, they didn't. It was offered for sale. Many parties were interested. Dave put his proposal to the guys that owned it. I think it was a small museum by this time. And although he couldn't offer to pay the most money, his proposal to actually rebuild a Typhoon to fly was accepted, and he got that fuselage in 2012.
Right, so the objective is to get this airframe flying.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking, is it not?
Quite an undertaking.
How are you going to go about
it? And when it's finished, certainly at the moment, it'll be the only one in the world that can fly. We are starting at the tail.
Yeah.
We've got around about 12,000 drawings, I believe, of various parts of the Typhoon, yeah. You know, as it was built. We're starting at the tail because there are a couple of Tempest projects running at the moment,
right.
And our Typhoon, the slightly later model, and the Tempest share the same tail.
Right. Okay.
So we're starting at the tail. We've got a couple of guys reverse engineering the drawings, putting them into SolidWorks, so that the tails probably later this year jigs can be made to start to be built. So then we will have the tail unit. We have the fuselage section, which, you know, many parts of that will need to be rebuilt, but we have that already.
Yeah.
And then we're looking to acquire a full cockpit section from engine mounts back to the fuselage joint and out to the wing spar this year.
Yeah.
That'll effectively leave us with the wings to go. We do have enough drawings to build them from scratch, but we're actually researching
a few sets of wings that we know
exist. It's just tracking them down.
So where is the where's this work being done? Where's the airframe at the moment?
So the airframe, the collection at the moment is with Dave in Staffordshire.
Yeah.
When it is built, it likely won't be in one place.
Right.
When the Typhoons were built during the war, parts were built at various locations and then brought together for assembly. And that's what we're going to do. We've got a lot of people who have volunteered their help to maybe build wing pins, or one company we've got has offered to build the spar.
Yeah.
So they'll be built all over, brought together somewhere like, you know, Duxford, which is the mecca for these kind of aircraft, or Hawker Restorations is another place we're in touch with. Lots of different places that want to do it.
Right. And what's the timetable then, Sam, for doing this? I know how long's a piece of string.
Yeah.
In the real world, when do you think this might start coming together?
We would like to see the Typhoon take some part in D-Day 75 celebrations, or commemorations, I should say.
Right.
Which is 2019. Now, that's obviously only 3 years away. So that is probably pushing it for her to be flying.
Right.
But certainly she would look like an aircraft by then, I would hope.
And is Dave a pilot?
No.
So
Dave has got the engineering
background.
You're
going to be looking to fly this?
Certainly. In the time it takes to build it, I'm looking to have added some higher power piston aircraft to my...
I was going to say, how does one go about getting qualified to do that?
Aircraft belong to different classes. And this is technically a single engine piston. It's in the single engine piston class, but it's high performance, clearly. And you just fly the relevant aircraft, you know.
Right, okay.
At the moment, I'm flying a Harvard, which is the trainer. You know, wartime pilots would have flown the Harvard.
Yeah.
And then quite possibly straight to the Typhoon.
Right.
That's not likely to be the case with me, but I'm hoping to get the keys, as it were, to a Spitfire, Mustang.
Yeah.
Get a lot of time on those.
And do you have, to get to that point, do you have things like the pilot's notes and any sort of feedback from, I don't know, books, history or whatever, that's going to give you a feel for how to fly it?
Yeah, absolutely. There are pilot's notes, originals. There's a few originals around, and there's plenty of copies of those sort of things. There's the technical manual where you can study everything about the aircraft that you would have done if you were flying it during the war.
What is the feel for what she was like to fly as an aircraft? Were there anecdotal information on what its foibles were and things like that?
A bit of a brute.
Right.
It would swing heavily to the right on takeoff. They would normally start the pilots. You would have the rudder trim, which relieves the rudder pedal forces.
Yeah.
You'd normally take off with that wound fully left.
Wow.
And then still need quite a bit of left rudder.
On top of that.
And a long runway. Yeah.
Okay.
When you've got a very low speed and all that power and torque from the engine. Once you get flying, I think she was a nice, stable aircraft. The technique for dive bombing, effectively it was, and releasing the rockets, was to start a dive from sort of 8,000 feet, getting upwards of 500 miles an hour. And everything we've read would suggest it's very heavy on the controls at those speeds.
Right.
But a very stable platform, just a bit of a brute, really, with all that power.
So coming back to your grandfather's story, he was shot down over Holland. Where was he flying from?
He was flying from RAF West Hampnett, as it was known then, what is now Goodwood Aerodrome.
Yeah, so his range was pretty good range.
Yeah, they could carry drop tanks.
Yeah,
I think the standard range without tanks was around about an hour and a half.
Right,
and I think the tanks may have added about half an hour to that.
Yeah,
but in that hour and a half, you've got to remember she's doing 400 miles an hour. Yeah. So
she's moving.
She gets
some.
A long way.
Yeah.
In quite a short space of time.
Right. Very, very fast. And coming back to Holland as well, and the interest that has been shown from there. What sort of relationship do you have with the people in Holland over this aircraft?
So there are quite a few groups in Holland. A couple of museums that have a lot of Typhoon parts, because the Typhoon's a significant part of their history.
Yeah.
Like in France as well, there's a lot of people interested over there, whereas here it's almost been forgotten.
Yeah.
Volkel Air Base is an important one. There were Typhoon stationed there late 44, early 45.
Right.
Quite a lot of activity there. So that is one of the locations we're hoping to dig up some of these parts.
Right, okay. It's a really exciting project. You've got a website, you're on social media. Where can we find out about you, Sam?
Our website is www.hawkertyphoon.com. Nice and easy to remember. If you search Hawker Typhoon and RB396 on Facebook, yeah, or Twitter, you'll find us. We're project_typhoon on Twitter. So all of those three avenues.
Okay, and how can people support you if they want to come out and show some support for this project?
Sure, a great way to support is just spreading the word. So yeah, get onto Facebook, Twitter, tell your friends, tell your family. Works wonders. We do have some merchandise arranged, which we're developing, you know, T-shirts, hoodies, cups, that sort of thing at the moment. Purchase through the website or Facebook and Twitter. So we can take donations. Clearly, this project is going to cost somewhere in the region, we anticipate, £4 million, which is a sum of money that neither Dave or I has. We're hoping once we can establish as a charity that we'll be able to get some lottery funding for a portion, although they won't fund the whole amount. But likely, a large portion of the fundraising will need to come from a lot of members of the general public, you know, supporting with 5, 10, 20 pounds here and there. We're hoping soon to start a supporters club,
right,
or a friends club, you know, where for a small annual membership, you'll be kept up to date with emails, newsletters, invites to events and open days, that sort of thing, and other things TBC.
Sam, a fantastic project. I congratulate you on the work you've done so far.
Thank you.
We wish you all the very best. Will you come back on the show maybe a little bit later in the year and tell us how it's going?
Absolutely. We will most certainly keep you posted.
Sam, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Amazing project there for Sam and Dave to recreate. I mean, it's a fantastic story that it was his grandfather and the air crash site in Holland that sort of generated and sparked his interest to restore RB396. He even said to me off air that they may be able to recover some of the parts from the crash site, and they're hoping to see if they can use some of them in the restoration. So it's an amazing story. But the Hawker Typhoon, bit of an unsung hero, isn't that one, Mick?
It is an unsung hero, but what a prospect for the air show scene. To me, it's the thought of seeing a Typhoon performing at an air show. Do you remember when, not so many years ago, the first of the Flugwerk FW190 replicas displayed at Duxford, and we were all transfixed watching it land on that stalky undercarriage, and it kind of bounced around stiffly, and just such a new scene on the airshow circuit. Such a brilliant thing to see, and in a way, the Typhoon when they do fly it will be a counterpart of that. It's another really powerful aircraft and something quite different from the run of the mill. I mean, they're beautiful Spitfires, Hurricanes, Messerschmitts, and Mustangs, but so great to see what's effectively a lost type back in the air.
Yeah, it'll be great. Tim, did you make the Airfix model when you were little?
I certainly did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's the original A10, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
To have something like that, maybe with like rocket pylons as well and D-Day stripes, bubble canopy. That would be so good to sort of see that on, you know, a real powerful, muscular aircraft like that. It's just got kind of menace, hasn't it?
Yeah,
great it really stuff. Has, yeah.
It's a great project. So good luck to Sam and Dave and the rest of the team there. Do get over to their website and give them every bit of support that you can. What an amazing project. Okay, let's move on after the break. We're coming back to you, Tim, for a brand new X10 Top 10.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Okay, and here we are. We're back with another X10 Top 10. So this episode, having flown the Optica, we look at the top 10 spy planes. Which type brought the best picture of that and contributed the most to intelligence. So I'm ready for the comments at the end of this. And number 10, the Supermarine Swift. A sad swan song for the famous Supermarine name. The Swift was hopeless as a fighter and a procurement disaster of the day. And its FR5 role, it excelled as a low-level tactical reconnaissance type for the RAF in the Cold War in West Germany. And number 9... McDonnell RF-101 Voodoo. Another type to gain more fame in the photo recce role than its original mission was the Voodoo. Ultra-fast down-low, the Voodoo saw action in Vietnam and also during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was also used by Taiwan. And number 8, Junkers GU-86P. This pressurized high-altitude aircraft with diesel engines was the U-2 of the first half of World War II and was the answer to the Luftwaffe's question, how the hell do you spy on Britain when it has such a fearsome air defence system? The answer was to go higher than 39,000 feet. Fun fact, in 1943, a modified Spitfire 5, shot one down at 49,000 feet over Egypt. Holy cow. And number 7, de Havilland Mosquito. Unarmed, fast and high, the iconic de Havilland Mosquito outran or flew higher than most of what Germany could throw at it in World War II. Only the advent of jet fighters like the Mi-262 could match the Molly's intruding. Not placed higher on this list, as it does so many other things well too. And number 6, General Atomics Predator. Few aircraft achieve the fame of their name being used as a public shorthand for a number of similar types or a whole class of flying machine. Jumbo jets comes to mind. However, the Predator UAV, developed by an Israeli inventor before being used in the Balkans by the US and then becoming a hold to kill air recently, has transformed the way in which intelligence and reconnaissance imagery is used and acquired. The Predator ushered in the age of real-time video, persistence, and remote operations. Now, number 5, the Lockheed F-4 or Stroke 5 Lightning. Photo recon version of the twin-boom, twin-engine Lockheed P-38. The F-4 F-5 saw the Lightning turn into a highly effective, long-range, and fast recce aircraft, seeing service in all theatres. Fun fact, the Royal Australian Air Force also flew the F-4 PR version of the Lightning, receiving a small batch in August 1942. And number 4, the MiG-25R Foxbat. While the MiG-25 Foxbat was designed as a Mach 2.8 interceptor, it also came in a reconnaissance variant, the MiG-25R. Flying from Egypt in the early 1970s, Soviet Foxbat recon pilots were able to cross Israel with impunity at high speed, also used by India, Libya and Syria. And there's some evidence that the Syrian ones may have been pressed into service as bombers in this country's recent civil war. And number 3, Lockheed SR-71. The second outing for the SR-71 on an X-10 Top 10, what cannot be said about the SR-71 Blackbird, the highest flying, fastest spy plane in the world. gathering crucial intelligence over Vietnam and Cold War borders. The Blackbird also provided key imagery at the time of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. The fastest carrier ever, the Blackbird was in and out before anyone could react. At number two, Supermarine Spitfire, all PR types. Spitfire's speed and performance meant it was natural to be turned into a high and low flying recon type in World War II. Flying unarmed and solo, PR Spitfires were flew over Berlin, surveyed the Atlantic Wall ahead of D-Day, and crucially also brought back photographic evidence of the V-weapons, aimed at England's heart. And number one, it has to be the Lockheed U-2. Once again, another Clarence Kelly Johnson masterpiece appears in the top 10. The U-2 broke new ground in aeronautics and clandestine design and development, but it's number one for its significance in reassuring US decision-makers that the much-vaulted bomber gap between the US and Soviets was just a myth. It also revealed that Soviet missiles were in Cuba and still provides valuable intelligence today, after the more exotic SR-71 has been retired and UAVs have come on to dominate elsewhere. Fun U-2 fact, a number of RAF pilots also flew U-2s with the US, even on dangerous missions over the Soviet Union. Even today, this will elicitate a no comment from the UK MOD. And there it is. That's my top 10 spy planes. Anyone else got any others?
Ooh, well done, Tim. Well done. Another good list. Do you know what? It's another one of those top 10s that could have been top 20s, really, couldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
You could have really added a few more. I was listening to stories about the RAF in the Mediterranean in the war, and the use of things like Sunderlands as well for spotting, I suppose. And I suppose they could have been classed as spy planes in their day. So
I was tempted with the Focke-Wulf 200 Condor, and then I thought, that maybe that's a top 10 maritime patrollers, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
To me,
there's one glaring omission, which my 91-year-old dad would not forgive me if I wasn't to bring up. My dad was the chief instructor at number 231 OCU, which was, of course, on the English Electric Canberra.
That was my other most glamorous
aeroplane, but a fantastic aircraft to fly, he tells me, and did a lot of reconnaissance work.
And of course, still operating as well.
There's the WB-57 in NASA.
That's right. Fantastic list, Tim. Yeah. Well done. Great. Well done. Well, if you've got any comments on that list, do drop us a line or Twitter, Facebook, email. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. Or, of course, use our voice pipe on our website. Leave us some audio feedback and give Tim some of your feedback on what you think about that top 10. So, Tim, well done.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, and so to the get involved and feedback section of the show, a few bits of feedback for you, just to keep you up to date on developments. We've been away for a while, so there is a hell of a lot to get through, but we picked a few things out we wanted to bring to you. The first one was some sad news from our friends down under, Plane Crazy down under, Steve and Grant. They had a very good friend, Ryan Campbell, and Ryan was he broke the world record for the youngest person to ever fly solo around the world in 2013, and Stephen Grant sponsored his aircraft on that trip. Very sadly, he was involved in an incident in a Tiger Moth recently where one passenger was killed and Ryan was very seriously injured. Now, Stephen Grant are looking to record best wishes for Ryan and send him some messages, and they'd love all the aviation fans around the world to help contribute to that. So if you feel like you want to send Ryan a message, you can contact Steve and Grant at planecrazydownunder.com, or you can use the email address contact@planecrazydownunder.com. So Ryan, please do get well very, very soon. Our very good friends at Slipstream Research. You remember these, Tim?
Yeah.
I think you you described the design on the show as looking like a baby stealth bomber. I think you described it something like that. Well, Captain Brian Link, of course, who was the Black Hawk and Osprey pilot who came on to talk to us in, way back in episode 19, sent us a note to say we're very proud to announce that the design work for the first aircraft, the Slipstream Model 313, has been completed. So fantastic news to everyone at Slipstream Research. We spoke to him, as I said, a couple of years ago when Brian came onto a show to talk about his about flying the Osprey and the Black Hawk. So we wish them every success, and I know Brian is very keen to come back onto the show to talk about that, and also some recent work he's been involved in with converting the Black Hawk to the glass cockpit. So we wanted to hear a bit more about that, so we'll get him back on the show as well. Okay, now one other article that we just wanted to insert here was we've got some great friends on the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook. I know, Mick, you're a great fan of this group on Facebook. It's a fantastic group. I know we've talked about them before, but we're thinking of every episode talking a little bit more about some of the aviation books that are out there, because there's some fantastic ones. I think they're Book of the Month is, I think it's Tornado Over the Tigris or something at the moment. But they've got some great stuff on this website. If you like aviation books, please do go over and give them a visit. And if you have a book that you particularly want to mention or you want to talk about that you're reading, why not drop us a line or talk to us on Twitter or Facebook, hashtag AvBook, and give us some feedback. What about you guys? What books are you reading at the moment? Anything exciting?
Oh, there's permanently loads of books on the go. One that I actually finished reading a short while ago, because I actually reviewed it for latest issue of TAH, is a biography of Sir Geoffrey de Havilland. Now, this hasn't been done properly before, weirdly. Mike Ramsden, who's perhaps better known as J.M. Ramsden, the editor of Flight International, right the way through the 1960s and 1970s, has produced a fantastic little book. It's not a complete blow-by-blow account of Sir Geoffrey's life, but it's written with real journalistic verve, real feel for a good story. And obviously Mike was a de Havilland apprentice, and anybody who's encountered de Havilland people over the years know that they all have this certain esprit de corps. The de Havilland Aircraft Company was like a big family, and that really comes across in this book. Really well worth reading, and you can get it from the de Havilland Aircraft Museum at Salisbury Hall.
Oh, excellent, excellent. What about you, Tim? Well, what are you up to? I know you've always got a pile of books on your desk.
One of them is from our good friend, Roland White, Into the Black.
Oh, so, you lucky boy. I haven't seen it yet.
Probably looking forward to sort of talking to him when he's on the show next. But, it is a very, very good book, indeed. All about the shuttle. Background to the first shuttle and the first flight, Crippen and Young. Really, really good. Highly recommended. I think you can probably say that. And the other thing I'm reading is something about quite a kind of an arcane subject, but sort of history of mission control, sort of NASA, ESA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that. I saw that
ESA,
book.
How that kind of developed. A lot of kind of interesting little kind of tiny little facts about sort of updating computers and trying to keep computer systems up to date and how it's all organized as well, you know. Quite interesting. So, yeah, two of my books on the go.
Excellent, excellent. I've got Carrying the Fire by Michael Collins. I'm reading through that at the moment, so that's really interesting. Very, very, very interesting guy. Very clean, straight talking. I've read all the other books about the Apollo flights, but I'd never seem to have got round to his story. So just mopping that one up. So that's my contribution to the book section for this episode. Just two very quick mentions for the Aviation Bookshop. I know lots of people in the UK are very keen to find out when they're out and about. The 5th of March, Saturday the 5th of March, they are, well, where are they? They're up at the Newark Air Museum, and on Sunday the 6th of March, they're at the East of England Model Show. So if you're interested in books, they are the guys to go and see. Okay, well, let's move on to promoting aerospace then. I'll kick off. Dave Homewood, very good supporter of the show from the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. They produce some really, really great content on historical aviation, and particularly good at teasing stories out about the Second World War as well. Well, they've got their Aviation Forum meet on the 5th and 6th of March down in New Zealand. So if you're interested in that, I know we have a lot of people in that part of the world who listen to the show. If you're not going to that forum meet, it's highly recommended. So good luck to Dave on that. The other mention I just wanted to put out there was the 2016 Aerospace Schools Challenge. This is, of course, for 16 to 18 year old students, and this year's challenge is to design a hypersonic transport aircraft. So this is open to schools, air cadet corps, aerospace colleges, and the prize at the end of it is a 5-night residential course at the School of Aerospace in Cranfield in July. So and along with that comes, of course, the ceremony in London at the IME in November, the school's Aerospace Challenge trophy, and a £5,000 prize. So it's well worth going after if you're an aviation student in the Air Cadets or studying aerospace at college. We'll put links to that in the show notes. Tim, how about you?
Okay, well, we've got an interesting an aviation film premiere the 22nd of February. It's in RAS HQ in London. Appreciate that. Obviously, some of you won't be able to get there, but if you are in the area on that night, we've got an interesting documentary. First time in, like I say, it's a premiere. First time in the UK. Wings on Deck. Now, this is a story of how U.S. Navy pilots were trained in World War II, and some very interesting stuff there on Lake Michigan, I wouldn't say the dummy aircraft carriers, but they were aircraft carriers. But there was a lot of sort of training done in the States before they were went out into active service out in the Pacific or wherever. So yeah, interesting kind of historical story there of training carrier pilots.
And just to remind everyone, it is your 150th anniversary, of course, at the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Yes, the Royal Aeronautical Society is. It's not mine. I'm not quite that old yet.
Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, so,
there's a lot going on, isn't there, this year?
Check the diary on the aerosociety.com website. There are special events going on throughout the year. There'll be new ones added, so if there's anything going on near you, take a look at the diary, turn up and celebrate 150 years of the Aeronautical Society.
And you know, let's be honest and brutal about this. Almost all of your events are free as well, and not only you don't have to be a member as well. So please do go and look some of those events up. So they're really, really good. Highly recommended. Mick, have you got any shout-outs?
Yeah, I've got a couple, actually. The first one just caught my eye on Facebook over the last couple of weeks, the Stirling Aircraft Project, this very long-term project to rebuild a forward fuselage section of a short Stirling bomber. Now, this project has been going for years, and they're steadily putting together, so far, mostly smaller parts like cockpit parts and things like that. But one of their guys fairly recently has started producing terrific CAD drawings of of the structure as it's going to be as the project progresses. And these illustrations produced on computer-aided design software really give you a fantastic idea of the complexity of the Stirling structure. So have a look, Stirling Aircraft Project on Facebook, or you can find their website at stirlingproject.co.uk. Well worth a look. The other thing I was going to draw your attention to, it was only announced today, and it's a bit like the Aerospace Schools Challenge. It's a slightly scholarly thing, but suits the aviation historian very well. The Royal Air Force Museum has teamed up with King's College London to fund a PhD student to study the business history of the British aircraft industry. So this chimes in with the Vickers V1000 article that we've got in our current issue. That they're putting up £15,000, so students who are eligible to study for a PhD can apply for that funding, which would basically keep somebody going for a year to look at the archive material in the RAF Museum and see what new light that can shed on the development of the British aircraft industry. Sort of, they're looking at themes of leadership, politics, innovation, all sorts of things that still haven't really been looked at fully. So that's a chance to make a real contribution to British aviation history.
Yeah, that's an amazing opportunity, isn't it? That's fantastic. Okay, I think that's just about all we've got time for then for this episode. Before we go, though, Tim, you're just about to jump on an aeroplane. Where are you off to?
I'm off to Singapore for the Singapore Air Show 2016, so looking forward to that. No F-35s there, but there is promised to be lots of exciting things to report on. So, hopefully I'll be able to have a report of that when I get back.
Excellent, excellent. And Mick, any plans for the coming month or two?
Yes, we're hard at work on TAH 15 as we speak. We've got amazing stories coming in for that. And then we're going to be at the not nearly as exotic as Singapore. In April, we're going to be at the Gatwick Aviation Fair with TAH again. So we'll be looking forward to meeting loads of friends there and hopefully recruiting some more subscribers.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I'm off to the farewell for the Sea King in Royal Navy service, so hope to bring you a feature on that in a coming episode as well. Okay, we'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, ukpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, you can find the Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com, and I'm tweeting regularly on Twitter at RESTimR.
And Mick, where can we find you online? I know you're active on social media.
Absolutely, yes, you can find us. Our website is www.theaviationhistorian.com. If you Google The Aviation Historian, we're all over the first page of a Google search. You can also find us on Facebook, The Aviation Historian, and also Twitter, at AvHistorian.
Excellent. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Mick Oakey.
Cheerio, folks.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.